Keeping It 101, a Killjoy's Introduction to Religion podcast. For 2022-2023, our work is made possible both through a UVM Reach Grant and a Luce AAR Advancing Public Scholarship Grant. We are grateful to live, teach, and record on the current ancestral and unceded lands of the Abenaki, Wabanaki, and Akwesasko peoples. As always, you can find material ways to support Indigenous communities on our website. What's up, nerds? Hi, hello. I'm Megan Goodwin, a scholar of American religions, race, gender, and politics. I am not Elise Morgenstein First, who, as you damn well know, is a historian of religion, Islam, race, and racialization, and South Asia. We are coming at you today with a very special bonus episode, a very special bonus conversation with pod goals, pod goddess, and aspirational pod bestie, Dr. Hannah McGregor, who is Associate Professor of Publishing at Simon Fraser University. Dr. McGregor's new book, A Sentimental Education, is now available wherever you get your books. We would love it if it were an independent bookstore, but, you know, do the best you can. And with that, we are here with Dr. Hannah McGregor, who is now Associate Professor of Publishing. Yes?
Yeah.
At Wilfrid Laurier University. Congratulations, and thanks so much for joining us.
Simon Fraser University.
Shit, I knew that. Wilfrid Laurier is your publisher and
not publisher. And my collaborator and my co-applicant on every award. Yeah, like I
Fine.
Basically
Simon
work
Fraser
there.
Is where you work, though.
Mm-hmm. It
would
is.
Probably appreciate us saying that. Very professional. Hi, Hannah. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Listen, they're both just universities named after dead white men. So why? We don't owe Simon Fraser or Wilfrid Laurier any memory of who they are.
So you work at some school and you wrote a book, I hear.
I wrote a book. I have to say this is my second book technically because I edited a book 4 years ago. And everything about that book was a nightmare.
I thought it was super chill. No?
Yeah.
Canlit and Ruins did not land super chill?
Yeah. Refuse Canlit and Ruins, the most stressful book in the world. Like, you know, one of our contributor authors got sued for content in the book, like, a week before the book came out. Like, everything about it was the least chill it's possible for a book to be. And it's so nice having a book coming out that nobody's mad at me about.
Isn't that amazing?
It's really good.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Mazel tov.
Yeah. Thank you. Incredible. I mean, which isn't to say that this book isn't also, you know, full of feminist opinions. It's just, I don't know. It's feminist opinions people are less surprised to find I hold or...
Well, just lawsuits involved. Once there's lawyers,
just no lawsuit,
then,
there's just
then it's
no
a disaster.
Lawsuits involved.
I mean, but.
I hope that laugh really echoed through the empty room that I'm sitting in. Yeah.
I mean, same.
So your book is called A Sentimental Education, and if I was really professional, I would actually have the subtitle.
No subtitle.
Oh, yeah. It's
baller.
It's a cool
what a
book.
Flash.
Does not need a subtitle.
Subtitle. When I first submitted, before I had submitted the final manuscript, I was filling out an author questionnaire for the marketing and promotion person. And there was a field for subtitle because academic books have subtitles. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a subtitle. I called it Essays on Care. And my editor wrote back to me and she was like, absolutely not, no subtitle. I'm deleting it.
I love that. That's pretty baller.
She's a great editor. And academic books actually don't have to have subtitles, turns out.
No, it's just trendy. It's just the genre.
Yeah, it's just the genre. It's just the genre norm. So instead I just stole a title from another dead white man.
Yes.
It was
all their things.
Now.
Yes. Love that. I will ask the first question like a goddamn professional. Hey, Dr. McGregor. What's most important for readers to know about A Sentimental Education? No subtitle.
I mean, okay, so the most important thing is to know that it doesn't have a subtitle. But the second most important thing to know is that it is I mean, you sent me these questions last night. Did I spend any time thinking about them? No, I spent that time girl, looking same. For I never, my lost podcasting yeah. equipment.
I never look at the questions and I should, and I never do anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I love to wing it. That's why I have
they weren't mandatory. They were there as an option. So like both of you are fine.
I love them. I
wrote them myself.
You know, for me, part of what makes me pause over a question like this is that I am trying to imagine a more expansive readership for this work than academic work conventionally receives, which has been part of the larger project of my scholarship over the past 6 years, is to really, really, really reimagine who scholarship is for in the first place. Mm-hmm. So if I was talking to readers who didn't think of themselves as academic readers, who were, you know, maybe in a very different discipline from me, or people who were not working in an academic capacity right now, the first thing I would say is, this is not a conventional academic book, and I wrote it to invite a wider readership. And so the first thing I would say is, like, actually, this book might be for you. Like, maybe there's something in here that you will find. And in that sense, both to academic, I would say something similar to sort of more conventional academic readers, which is, I wrote this to be as little like a conventional academic book as I could. And I say as I could, because I think I could have pushed it further, but writing the book was a process of unlearning my own academic voice. And so the whole process of writing it was a real push-pull between how I am used to writing and the kinds of rhythms of academies I fall back into as I write, and then the moments of pushing away. But I would really say to readers that I tried to write the book as an invitation into a conversation, and particularly a conversation about how it is that we learn and how it is that particularly the texts we engage with shape the way that we move through the world and the kinds of communities that we form. And so in that sense, I really hope that the book serves as an invitation into conversation rather than a sort of proclamation of of various authoritative opinions.
I love that. And I'm hoping we can also maybe talk a little bit more about what that process was like for you, given that Elise and I are in the midst of a similar process.
Yeah.
It's great. Absolutely. Everything's fine. The book's going to be great. Say that with your chest. I actually do think the book's going to be great.
I believe you. I believe you. And I feel the vulnerability of it. I think conventional academic writing is like a discursive suit of plate armor. Like, it is bulky and unwieldy and impractical, but the one thing it is very good at doing is protecting you.
Yeah
it's really hard for people to get through. You're like, oh, me, I'm not a person, I'm just a set of ideas contained in a mesh of citations, so
and some words when, that I made up
and some words that I made up. And so, you know, when you are hit by the cruelty of academia, which you will be, because there's a lot of cruelty in this culture, it is easier to withstand it because it doesn't feel like those attacks are coming at you. They're coming at a bunch of ideas, and you can't hurt the opinions of ideas. And so it's scary to do it differently, because it makes you vulnerable. And then you have to figure out, like, okay, what will I do now if somebody's like, I think your book is terrible? And you're like, the part about my dead mom? Single tear?
Yeah. Oh, that's... Well, go ahead. That's a lot. But you're not wrong. The armor of academia and the weaponry of academia, because I often think of citations as like a really great Swiss Army knife. Like, because I do a lot of translation work, because my work is situated in South Asia and global empire. And so there's a lot of like, you might come at me, random white dude, usually because my field, but like, I found this random manuscript and I did it, and it's in three languages, and you don't have access to the translation except for what I'm giving you. So like, right? Like, it's like a bring it on, man.
Yeah.
And like, whew, like I've got go my ahead. Little like corkscrew thing. Yeah, go ahead. That's my
go ahead.
Don't make fun of my accent that much.
I'm not. I'm celebrating your accent. I love it.
Yeah, no, it really is like a go ahead, motherfucker. Like, come on. You didn't read this, so you can't attack me. But what I hear you saying about a sentimental education, which gets delivered to my Kindle in a few days.
Yes.
Is that it's not just an exercise in unlearning, but it's an exercise in deciding how to be vulnerable and connect with an imagined audience that is inherently a different audience than maybe who you're used to writing for. Though we would like to ask you questions about your expansive public scholarship, because that's obviously a thing that you do and are committed to.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is, you're right, a deliberate decision, and a deliberate decision to speak to the audience that I kind of found out existed via my podcasting work. Maybe a combination of found out existed and also, you know, when you publish, you create publics. So, you know, also sort of called into being by virtue of doing this work. Differently
as hell. Love it.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
It is though. My friend
Zena Sharman, who is this wonderful queer writer and organizer, has her area of research is queer and trans access to healthcare. And she has a book out called The Care We Dream Of. That is just an absolutely incredible sort of set of essays by her and by a variety of other writers about radically reimagining the world as one in which we are all fundamentally deserving of care. And she talks about that book as being a spell that she is, you know, right, that by daring to dream these things, we can dream them into being. There's a fire alarm going off.
Awesome. Awesome.
I think about the way, you know, I stumbled into podcasting as public scholarship. It was kind of an accidental sidestep. Like, I didn't know that was the direction I was going in. But at some point I made the decision to say, like, this is going to be the kind of scholar I am. This is going to be the kind of work that I do. I'm going to be vulnerable. I'm going to take risks. I'm going to do things that feel to me like they matter instead of things that feel like they are smart career choices. And they, you know, they worked out for me, but they really could have not.
Oh, yeah.
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 That actually feeds into one of my next questions. What's at stake in doing this kind of vulnerable, and I hate the word authentic, but it feels raw and true and like manifesty of the kind of academy that I think we would all like to continue to build. But you point out that there are real risks there too. So yeah, what's at stake in a project like A Sentimental Education coming soon to Kindles and actual bookstores near you?
So there's two ways of talking about those stakes, right? So there's what we risk, and then there's what we get by virtue of taking those risks. What becomes possible when we take those risks and make ourselves vulnerable? And what we lose is, again, that sort of suit of armor of authority. And I definitely came up in the kind of academic culture that said, you know, people will take you less seriously. You are a young woman. And so you must be ruthlessly professional. You must be ruthlessly authoritative. You must always be the best read person in the room. You must never admit to a weakness. You must constantly be on. You have to constantly be doing more than everybody else. You know, this is how you become an academic, is by never, ever stopping working and never, ever letting your guard down. And that is one version of success in this field. And it's one version of sort of how you garner respect. And I remember the moment where Marcel and I, you know, sat down and had a conversation about making a podcast about Harry Potter, which is, which please. And recognizing that it could be a vulnerability on the job market because people can hear this podcast and they can hear us getting drunk and laughing and making crude jokes and crying and all of this stuff, and making the decision, like saying out loud, I would be unhappy having the kind of job that required me to pretend to be somebody I'm not for the rest of my life. Like, that is not worth it for me. And so, I'm going to be the person I want to be out loud. And if I can't do this job being that person and living in alignment with my values, then I won't. I'll do something else. It's not worth it. And what came out of that is this amazing ability to make real, genuine connections and communities with people that I never knew was possible. Like, I didn't know academia could be a kind place. I didn't know that it could be a place where we, like, hold each other up and care for each other and see each other in all of our, you know, vulnerability and our failings. I didn't know, you know, I really believed, for example, that in order to be a successful academic, you had to be a ruthlessly hardworking neurotypical person. And if you were disabled or you were neurodiverse or you had anything happening in your life that took you away from constant work and productivity, well, you just couldn't do it. Like, sorry, them's the breaks. You just can't do it. It's too hard. And then just reaching a moment where I was like, oh, you actually, I don't have to believe that. I can just act as though that's not the case, refuse to work in that way, refuse to treat my students that way, refuse to treat my colleagues that way, model all the time a different way of doing things. And then at least in the little tiny pocket that I occupy, it can actually be different.
Yeah, we're hard subscribers to that universe. I mean, that's not dissimilar from where Megan and I come in as academics or in grad school when we decided that we needed different sets of supports and each other, really. Yeah. And so, like, one of the things I really appreciate about your work, both in podcasting and from, like, the bits I've read, are the ways that it's clear that you do this in community, and that I think you're taking the ideal or the ideology maybe of academia that says, like, well, we cite each other because we're in conversation with each other, and instead say, like, right, we're in conversation with each other, so let's actually be collaborative thought partners instead of competitive, like, assassins where the only way I can dunk or the only way I can succeed is to dunk on others and to, like, tear apart, you know, like, that piece of the deconstruction doesn't make sense. And I know, Goodwin, your thing is that we always need, like, the deconstruction argument of, like, deconstruction is really construction. And
it's not my argument. It's Derrida's.
I know, but I can't cite Derrida. So I cite you because I cannot.
That's fine. I accept that. Yeah. But I do really appreciate what y'all are saying about imagining into being an academic space that is genuinely collaborative and supportive and kind, as opposed to using citations as weapons, right, or as armor, and just waiting for your turn to talk, right? Allowing ourselves to actually be changed by the people we're in conversation with, rather than just getting in why we're different and better and working harder and a realer scholar than everybody else, because that's gross and I hate it.
But I think one of the other things I hear you saying in Stakes, if I can, like, steal your language and flip it around, is that it also helps us reimagine expertise. Because if we're not just talking with academics and we're not just using citations that only five of us have access to, then what we're doing is also reimagining who gets to be an expert and who gets to speak with authority. And I think that's also, again, not new. That's not new information, or that's not a new political realignment of how we think, but it's 100% like a radical perspective on expertise and mastery, as we all exist in this, like, cishet white settler space of institution and authority. So I quite like that. And I think that feels like a real thing, that I'm hoping to get out of A Sentimental Education, coming soon to bookstores and Kindles near you.
A very sort of powerful thing happened to me when I moved to Vancouver and started my tenure track job, which is that I moved into a very small department that was outside of my conventional discipline. You know, I was trained as an English scholar. I moved into a publishing program. The publishing program is at SFU Vancouver, which is a downtown campus quite far away from SFU's main campus, which means that I didn't move close to the university. I just moved into the city. And we're a professional program, so most of our alumni work in the publishing industry. And as a result of all of these various, you know, events, I didn't make friends with any other academics when I moved here.
It's a blessing.
Yeah. So my Vancouver community is artists and publishers and organizers and like people who are in community, doing work in community. And they might have, you know, various affiliations. You know, a number of the writers I know also teach in the creative writing program, but they do not understand themselves as academics first and foremost. They understand themselves as writers and community members. And the difference between being somebody who like theoretically believed that expertise came from multiple spaces and then somebody who just literally my community, it's just not academics. Mm-hmm. Like it's not who I'm in literal conversation with. When I'm working through a tricky idea, the people I go to talk about it are people who are thinking through that idea from many, many different perspectives, professional perspectives, personal perspectives, who, you know, are in different family formations than I am, who have different backgrounds than I do. And so I literally come to understand things differently because I am literally in conversation with different people. Yeah. And it's so different as an actual lived experience than as a theoretical one, to just be like, in a very practical way, I understand how publishing works better now because I used to talk about publishing with a bunch of other academics, and now I talk about publishing with publishers.
Right. Radical. I love it.
Yeah, who are like, let's talk about how it actually works because I actually do it. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
Wild. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Huge if true.
All right. Having just dunked on the academy across the board, I will now do.
We can do that.
Yeah, can.
That's our jobs, in fact.
Mm-hmm. It's fine. What are they going to do? Not hire me? I'm good.
Good win.
Having done all of the dunking, I'm going to ask an obnoxious academic question, and maybe it doesn't actually fit with sentimental education. But if you were going to sum up your argument for us of A Sentimental Education, what are you arguing in this book?
I mean, I'm barely arguing at all. But I would say what I am trying to articulate is the conundrum that those of us who love literature and other cultural texts have experienced the way that they change us. The way that when we read something or watch a really powerful film or listen to an amazing podcast, we feel changed. And yet, any external evidence suggesting that reading makes people better is specious. Right? Highly literate cultures are not more moral.
Nope.
Education and literacy and publishing have been used as tools of colonialism and imperialism and violence. Yeah.
Puritans, 98% literate. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Right? Like, the first press in Canada was created by one of the architects of the residential school system. You know, we can't, these systems are... Yep. Deeply entangled with one another. Education is deeply entangled in genocide. We can't, like, we just can't divide them. And so what do we do with that? what do we do with this desire to say, art matters and art has changed me and art has shifted the way I live in the world. And at the same time, in the middle of, you know, the Black Lives Matter uprising, saying here are 10 books by Black authors that you should read is such a useless gesture. And so what do we do with that? How do we reconcile this belief that like education exists and is possible? We learn, we change, we grow. I mean, we're teachers. We have to believe that's true. And we have been students our whole lives. So we also have experienced the truth of that. How do we reconcile that with a knowledge that like a reading list does not change the world? A university is not an inherently good space. The experience of being educated is not an inherently liberatory experience. Mm. And it was just me kind of trying to work at that impasse that I have continually come back to as a thinker, that I'm like, okay, the person who wrote the Harry Potter books is actively using her position and her cultural authority to attempt to strip away rights from a whole category of human beings. Mm-hmm. Like just one of the most insidious things you could possibly do with mm-hmm. that level of cultural power. And also, when I gather together with other people who have read and cared about her books, we have really transformative experiences together of reading in community.
Yeah.
What do we do with these two simultaneous truths, neither of which writes the other out of existence? Like we gotta hold both of them.
Right. Cool. What do we do? Fix the academy.
I think it's that's you're asking fix the academy. That's like a fix the universe question, right? Because like she wrote the book. It's good.
I wrote the book and the closest I came to a conclusion is that what we do is we work slowly and in conversation with each other. Mm. And we stay ready to be wrong. Not in the mode of like, you know, sort of touchy white lady, like, oh, I'm probably saying that wrong. You stay. I mean, the same way, you know, like when you're in a relationship with any other human being, you have to be ready to have been the person who was wrong.
Mm.
Like in a particular interaction, like you just have to be ready to be like, oh yeah, wow, I messed up and I apologize and I will try to do better.
Yeah, I'm the person who's wrong like 70, 80 times a day with Elise. It's great. It's very comfortable.
I am like a human wrecking ball. I am wrong constantly.
Love that for us.
I'm a lot. I'm often wrong. So I've gotten good at apologizing. It's that. Just do it in all of your relationships, right? Which is both simple and incredibly, incredibly complex, of course, because that's what human relationships are. But, you know, like, what do? You do what the two of you are doing, right? You build collaborations that are genuine and rooted in friendship, and you experiment and you keep trying to do things differently, and you push yourself to the edge of your comfort zone again and again to try to make the work that you're doing more meaningful, and you just keep doing that.
Good. Sorted. Great. Thank you. No further questions. Less.
I have a couple more questions.
All right. Fine. I was wrong. I'm sorry.
Beautiful, beautifully modeled.
I grew up Catholic. I'm very comfortable apologizing for things.
Yeah. Also, I feel like it is our pattern for you to just. Sorry, Elise. I ran you over again.
My bad. Some argument about whether I've actually learned anything from that or will not do it again, but I am sorry.
No comment. No, just kidding. You've learned very well. You no longer come at me straight with all your feels. You like evade so that I'm not uncomfortable or skittish like a scared cat.
There's the briefing before the feels reveal, yeah, so that you know what kind of response.
Yeah, no, you have learned that like bursting out into tears right at me is a good way for me to be like, I'm done. I don't know what to do, yeah, and I need a 5-minute walk. And then I can come back and be cool. But you are usually like, I need to cry now. And then I'm like, great, on it. I'm ready. Like, ready to receive.
And you know, that's a beautiful practice of asking for consent.
Of course. Sure.
I'm working on it.
I appreciate that both of you seem able to do like crying as pedagogy. And I'm just like, I'm frozen. I'm gonna freeze my way out of that. But
I am more likely to do accidentally making other people cry as pedagogy because I do have quite a sort of thick skin inherently. And so I'll like, you know, encounter something horrifying and be like, I really need to like mull this over. I really need to like just spend time. And then I'll like present it to other people and be like, look at this horrifying thing. I'm really thinking it over. And then they're sobbing. Like I read.
Yeah.
I read.
And I'm always like, what? Out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sad. Everything's like sad. Keep trucking.
I read. Yeah. Like it's horrifying. Of course we live in a horrifying world. Why are you crying? Dumb. How could this possibly have put you off your lunch? Aren't you kind of low key thinking about the horrors of the world all the time?
All the time. All the time. Pass the bagel.
All the time. Yeah. And then they're like, you know, weeping and like, I can't, maybe could you give us more of a warning next time? And I'm like, yes. Mm-hmm. Consent is important. You're right. You're right. Mm-hmm. But it's hard because I don't know what other people are going to find horrifying.
Totally. I don't know what's going to make Megan cry. My assumption is most everything.
It's true. Well, that's A, accurate, and B, I'm like super menstrual right now, so it's just
But Goodwin, I've like told stories on the podcast and then you've just like wept and I'm like, I didn't, it was just a story about nothing, we were talking about dinner and you're like crying. I can't anticipate your tears.
No, you can't. I can't either. No. Just like I would love to be able to give people a heads up that I'm gonna weep, but it surprises me too.
Yeah,
many things that my body does surprise me.
Sure. If crying is both feminist pedagogy and consent practices are just good feminist activity, Hannah, what do you think is next for feminist public scholarship? It's quite the left turn, but I'm trying to keep us on time. I saw what time it was.
Yeah. You know what I have been thinking about a lot lately is, so my work around podcasting and the kind of writing I'm doing right now is about sort of trying to create possibility models for doing feminist scholarship otherwise, as well as particularly with the podcasting work, trying very hard to also build the infrastructure so that it's not just me who gets to do it, but other people also can do this work. Because for me, a big part of building out the possibilities for doing unconventional and community-based scholarship is recognizing that the people who are most likely to be engaged in that scholarship are the people who are the most precariously situated within the institution. And so it is really important to say, like, community-engaged work, accessible work, public work matters, because for the most part, it is Black, Indigenous, people of color, queer, disabled, trans scholars who are doing this work. I think the next thing that is interesting to me is to think about, is there a way that we can begin to articulate our work that divorces it entirely from the logics of productivity? Because podcasting and book writing, I might be doing it differently, but I'm still producing a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's stuff you can point at and you can count and you can say, look, she might not be writing journal articles, but she made all of these podcast episodes and this many people listened to them and this many people did, you know? So look, it still counts because it still falls within, you know, a certain logic of productivity. But a lot of this work, particularly deeply community engaged work, is unproductive on the surface for enormous periods of time, right? If you're going to build actual community relationships, you're not necessarily building them in public. A lot of the time you're building them in community. Mm-hmm. So via conversations, via showing up, via, you know, actually being there and doing that. And so how can we make space for an expansive sense of what our work is that doesn't just come back to bean counting again and again?
Yeah, this is very close to my heart. I had a number of these conversations in a previous position. I will cut that.
It's hard, right? Because I know so many scholars who are doing incredibly important work that the university is, you know, delighted. Universities are like, oh yeah, look at all your community engaged mm-hmm. work. Oh, look at your connection to all of these communities. It's going to look so good for us mm-hmm. that you have all of these meaningful mm-hmm. community connections.
Until they ask you to do some stuff that addresses systemic inequalities that universities are complicit in. And then it's not.
Yeah,
it's
great, I mean, and they like. Until you say something to the university that they don't like.
Yeah.
And until you get to your tenure review process mm-hmm. and they're like, where are all your single authored, double blind peer reviewed journal articles?
Yeah. And what's the Q score?
And you're like
that matters.
Yeah. And you're like, well, but I was doing all the things that you said you wanted me
you liked it.
For all of this other stuff that you said was the whole thing you hired me for. Mm-hmm, oh, mm-hmm. sorry. I was supposed to be doing that whole job and also secretly this mm-hmm. second yep. job. Mm-hmm, yep. I was just supposed to do two jobs. The answer mm-hmm. is yes. You were just supposed yeah. to do two mm-hmm. jobs.
And a third job, right? Like my university is really content to have us exploit our community partnerships for other purposes, right? Like mm-hmm. the number of times folks are like, oh, you do this activism work, which I will not name here. Could you get our students internships with that organization? And it's like, nah, bro, like that's not how this
not
works.
What we're doing.
And also like these people are not here for your consumption and your exploitation, right, yeah. but that somehow is then uncounted, unquantifiable, unimportant or mm-hmm. or rendered yeah. unimportant. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it can't be translated into the kind right. of things that the university cares about, which is research money and tuition.
Yep. yep. And donors.
Yeah. And, yeah. We don't have those here, but yeah.
Okay. Well, in America, that's all.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Yeah. I like idea of non-productivity. What?
Oh, I also like the idea of non-productivity. I was going to wait. Does the Canadian government just give schools to universities to universities?
So we have a 100% public post-secondary education system. We don't have a private system.
What?
And so, yeah. And so all of our universities are partially publicly funded, but that public funding has been systematically stripped away over the past, you know, three decades. And so increasingly universities are financially reliant on tuition. Mm-hmm. You know, our tuition rates are still much lower than they are at private universities in the States, but they are, you know, creeping up year over year. And particularly our universities are reliant on international students whose tuition is not capped by government policies. And so we can charge international students, you know, 3 to 5 times as much. And so we do a lot of sort of actively trying to attract international students because they pay for the university.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah.
That's the same in the States, including public schools. So I work at a public university, but we are still beholden to those kinds of capitalist problems.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. University system everywhere. Super good. 10 out of 10, no notes.
It's an imperialist system. It's not going to be good.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not going to. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, there always for me is this question of, is the institution, you know, is it redeemable? Is there hope within this institution? Or is it something that we need to burn down and find other ways? And I don't know the answer to that, but that's fine because I am not single-handedly responsible for it.
You are not.
That's fair.
Like, I'm not.
We haven't tried burning it down yet. Like, I feel like we tried a bunch of other stuff.
Some people have tried burning it down.
Yeah.
And like, you know, in little
more fires.
What if we set more fires is a really good
question.
Like that should also go on a sampler. What mm-hmm. if we set more fires?
Mm-hmm.
You know, curious. So what's the fire you're going to set tomorrow? Like what is the piece of of sort of the piece of the institution that mm-hmm. you have uncritically received as just the way things are, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm, tomorrow mm-hmm. you can be like, I wonder if this is flammable.
I love it. I love this is an intention setting. Yeah. I love this is an intention setting, like exercise in the morning. Like, okay, well, what can I queer today? And yeah. what am I setting on fire?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Love this. Love this. Yeah. Burning down the house.
Good one. Can I ask the last question that's not on your list? Surprise question.
Surprise question?
The secret question is just to channel Judith Weisenfeld's final question to all of our guests last year.
I like that.
Judith Weisenfeld, who asked us, because of course she did, because we had her on because we were fangirling, and mm-hmm. she was like, what if I mentor you? And we were like, great.
Yes, please.
Please always mentor me. Adopt me. Readopt me. I love being adopted. That's like my whole thing.
That's true.
So Judith Weisenfeld asked all of our guests, or she asked us and we asked all of our guests, what is the work you're most proud of?
Not a sweet question.
Yeah, it's a really sweet question. I mean, right now I'm really proud of this book because as it has begun to move through the world and I have seen people begin to respond to it, I think that it has said the thing that I wanted it to say.
That's amazing. And I am
proud of having articulated what I was trying to articulate in a way that is getting through to other people. And you know what? Any successful moment of communication is really something to celebrate.
Yeah. That's fucking rad. I love
and
that.
And few and far between. So that's awesome. I'm glad to hear that you feel really proud of this book. It seems like both in like reviews and digging around, and I had stupidly thought my copy would come ahead of this conversation. So that's my fault. But it seems like a thing to be proud of.
Send that to you.
It's too late. It's too late.
Bad.
It's too late.
Did you have it and didn't send it to me?
I thought you were on that email.
I love you so much, Megan. And that feels so typical of us.
I'm sorry. I'll try.
I'm going to wait.
It's a beautiful book.
It is a beautiful book. I'm going to buy it anyway. Well, I was going to ask, in the spirit of collaboration, who else's work you're really excited about right now? Who else should our nerds be checking out?
I have such a big stack of books that I am so excited to read now that it is like sabbatical time and I get to actually like read something. The person who I am feeling particularly inspired by right now is Catherine McKittrick, whose most recent book, Dear Science and Other Stories, I have begun and is one of the most excitingly experimental academic texts I have read. I cite that book in this book based on having just read the first essay. And it's one in which she says that in academia, we spend too much time talking about what we know and not enough time talking about how we know what we know and where we know from. And that has been really sticking with me. And Dear Science and Other Stories is sort of her extended project of like really thinking through where we know from. And so that's whose work I'm feeling really excited about.
That's rad.
That sounds awesome.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I can't wait to read your book that you already sent me, but I didn't read it yet.
Yeah, you know what? It's very short. So whenever you find the time, reading should be a pleasure, not a slog. So whenever you find the time, I hope you like it.
Walking through the high seas.